Good morning, everyone, and welcome. Our first case for this morning is case number 063574, United States against White. Mr. Leonard?
May it please the Court. Mike Leonard on behalf of Appellant Derek White. I would first like to address the Batson issue. And the crux of the issue was that the government, at the peremptory challenge stage, struck three of the five remaining African Americans. And the district court immediately and intuitively smelled a Batson violation. She indicated that she was really bothered by it and that it was troublesome. And with respect to at least one of those challenges, it was easy to see why the trial judge was concerned, and that was juror Miss Jackson, because, and it's important to understand the background of what happened at the for cause stage. Miss Jackson testified she did not have any child care problems, specifically making that statement. Conversely, another white juror, Ms. DeVries, indicated that she did have child care problems and didn't have a sitter for the rest of the trial except for that day. The defendant moved to strike the white juror for cause because of that obvious child care issue that she had expressed, and the government objected, claiming that the black juror, Ms. Jackson, also had a child care issue as well, even though she had specifically stated she did not. After the district court rejected that contention that the black juror had any child care issues, the government took two positions. One was that the black juror should not be struck, and we'll see that they later changed their position on this. And they also took the further position that it had to be one of two ways. Both Jackson and DeVries either on the jury or they're neither one's on the jury. So it was the government that made this racial linkage that if the black juror must go, the white juror must go. But the black juror can stay if the white juror can stay as well. And the judge at that time took the position that neither of those two jurors would be struck in for cause. Then we get to the peremptory challenge stage. Now, at that point, the government struck three of the five remaining black jurors or veneermen. And
no objection to two of them, right?
Correct. That's correct. Well, we objected all three, but we would concede that as to two of them, they did provide race-neutral reasons. However, as to the third, the one which we're appealing on and one we raised at the district court, Ms. Jackson, the government was required to give a response after the judge's concerns, and they came up with the allegedly race-neutral reason of she has child care issues, but as you recall, they previously said they wouldn't strike for cause for that issue, and they further said that we think that her mind will be on child care issues and she won't be able to concentrate. There was no basis upon which to make either of those statements.
Well, first, no basis. She has nine children.
Correct.
Two of them have serious illness. Her mother's there, and I think she had an in-law there, but it wasn't like there's not a concern.
Well, I would agree with you that she did say that she had nine children. However, Your Honor, if you read the entire transcript, she later states specifically, I don't have a child care problem. I have my mother. And she further states, I have a caregiver, which is presumably yet another party. And her only concern was the hypothetical that if one of her kids did get sick, that she might have an issue, just like anybody would have an issue. When the judge explained to her, though, that what the schedule of the trial was going to be, she said okay. She didn't raise any concerns whatsoever. And what the trial court failed to do, though, at that point, is they did not make any inquiry into the honesty of the proffered reason by the government. Instead, the government basically said, well, I'm going to accept your explanation, but only because you're offering to cure it. I'm only going to accept it because you're saying you will impanel the third alternate, who's black, and put them on the jury. So she didn't make any finding on the honesty, and in fact indicated by her comments she didn't feel the explanation was honest, but she was willing to accept the fact that this horse trading could go on. The government could essentially pick and choose which black juror it liked better, and that would somehow cure their own violation. Now, the government would tell you they were doing this because they were good guys. Clearly, they were doing it because they had been caught. And they suggested this cure, which doesn't go to address the Batson issue. The question is to each juror, Ms. Jackson had the entitlement under Batson to be on that jury. And the fact that the government said, well, we'll give you another black, we'll take a fungible commodity, black jurors, and we'll give you another one, then that's okay. that was inappropriate, and it's offensive, and it strikes at the heart of what Batson sought to do. Jackson had the right to be on that jury just like anybody else.
Didn't the district court come back and explain the ruling later on?
Well, I think her best explanation is where she basically said, I will accept the government's reason because of the cure offered by the government. Let's leave it at that. I think that was her clearest statement on the issue. That's at, it's not the right appellate site, but page 182 on the transcript. I'm going to accept their reason in view of their willingness to replace the juror with another African-American who wouldn't have otherwise been on the regular group. I'll leave it at that. That constitutes a reversible error. They shouldn't be able to pick and choose which black juror they want. Ms. Jackson had the right to be on that jury. And on appeal, their response is unpersuasive. They say, well, gee, the defendant at trial made 12 strikes of whites. There was never an issue raised before the trial court about any particular strike being race-based, and it wasn't. In addition, the government's second response is this is waived, in that you accepted this cure we offered, and therefore you can't raise the issue. That, too, was false. At two points in this colloquy, counsel, myself, indicated, number one, in the middle or beginning of the argument, that we want both. We want both in panel one and give us another, was the quote. And then at the end of the argument, I stated specifically that our position is that Ms. Jackson should be impaneled. And tellingly, nobody responded to that. The district court and the government did not say, no, this is an agreement. You can't raise the issue. You can't hold that position. No one said a word because it was clear that was our position, that Jackson should be on the jury. So for that reason alone, Mr. White is entitled to a new trial. The second issue that infused this entire case is the question of conspiracy versus gang membership. And really what this case was a state court shooting case. And in fact, it was filed as a state court shooting case in the Circuit Court of Cook County. It pended there for several years and then was dismissed when the prosecutor joined the U.S. Attorney's Office and it was folded into the BD conspiracy case. And the problem was for the government, they essentially tried two cases. They tried a shooting case first. They put on all the Chicago Police Department officers, presented evidence of a shooting case, and then presented a wholly separate case, a mountain of evidence about a conspiracy. So the shooting case simply involved a gang member, Mr. White. The conspiracy case involved allegedly the other 45, 46 defendants in a large, vast conspiracy lasting, according to the government, 15 years. Interestingly, not one shred of evidence came out about the conspiracy that Mr. White ever even once communicated with the other 45 members at any time about anything that related to the conspiracy. There were hundreds of hours of video taken, nothing to do with Mr. White. They presented audio testimony, nothing to do with Mr. White. They presented evidence about tons of drugs being purchased, mixed, distributed, nothing to do with Mr. White. They presented evidence at trial of millions of dollars of money collected, millions of dollars of earned, evidence of money spent on attorneys, commissary accounts. Not one iota of it had to do with Mr. White. They presented evidence of the drug conspiracy through evidence about the hierarchy, meetings, picnics, beatings of conspirators, beatings of others by conspirators.
I thought he gave a custodial statement admitting that he was working the gang's dope operation.
His statement to the arresting officers at the time was, to two gentlemen, to Officer Moore was, I was working security. According to Detective O'Brien, he stated, and on cross-examination, O'Brien admitted, he stated, I was working security. So they may have established that he was working in a gang capacity in a building that was generally controlled by the BDs, but they did not show in any way he was a member of the conspiracy. They also introduced other days of testimony evidence, none of which related to Mr. White, murders, stashes of guns, drugs, and money, etc. It went on and on for 2 days, 3 days. None of it had anything to do with Mr. White. So at the end of those two cases, what we had was a thin shooting case, which arguably credibility questions remain, so the juror could have found that he was involved in a shooting. We would concede that. However, the fact that he was a member of a gang in a shooting does not make him a member of the 45 or 46 person conspiracy, and there was no linkage. One would think that out of the 45 gang members, one of them could step forward and say, I know him. I know this co-conspirator. I know what he did. The government tried in two instances and failed. They called two co-conspirators, Mark Hall, who testified that he was vaguely aware of the building at which the shooting occurred, and he testified that he didn't know anything about Mr. White, never heard of him, never saw him before. They also called one of the kingpins, Mr. Volker, who was not involved in any way in the building that Mr. White was arrested at. And all Mr. Volker could say is that years before, he had run in, had a happenstance encounter with Mr. White, nothing to do with the drug conspiracy, and he claimed that on that occasion, Mr. White asked him for some money. So that is the best the government could do. So we simply have gang membership not linked to conspiratorial activities, and that's simply insufficient. And I'd like, also like to briefly address the issues with respect to counts 17 and 19, which are the commission of a violent crime in aid of racketeering and possession by a felon of a firearm. Both of them, as you know, require proof beyond a reasonable doubt of the interstate commerce connection. They're not technicalities. They're elements of the offenses, and the government failed to meet their burden in both instances. The most glaring one was with respect to the count 17, where the government had to prove that the coke or heroin was manufactured somewhere outside of Illinois and that it somehow got its way here as part of this conspiracy. So they called Mr. Coleman from the Will County Sheriff's Department. He first admitted he didn't know anything about the case, didn't know one fact about this conspiracy that's been going on for 15 years, and he didn't participate in the investigation in any way whatsoever. And with respect to the cocaine, he testified unequivocally on cross-examination, I don't know where it was manufactured. And he admitted that it's possible to manufacture cocaine in the United States. Similarly, with respect to the heroin, he testified on cross-examination specifically, he doesn't know where the heroin was manufactured or where it was imported, and he testified on cross specifically it was possible to manufacture the heroin in the U.S. He was indeed a curious choice of witness in light of the fact you probably could have called any one of 45 co-conspirators to tell us where the drugs came from. It was the government's choice to put Mr. Coleman on the stand, essentially an empty vessel who knew nothing about the drugs, and therefore they failed to meet the burden. Likewise, with respect to the possession by a felon of a firearm, the government also called one witness, again, their choice, and he too failed to meet the interstate commerce requirement. The best you could say is that typically markings on the guns denote the place of manufacture. He discovered there were two markings, suggesting possibly Nevada or possibly California. He didn't bother to speak to anybody at the manufacturer, any one of the hundreds of former employees who might know where the gun was actually manufactured, and instead relied upon speculation that it might be one of those locations. But there was no testimony that Lorson, the manufacturer, did not produce guns in Illinois. And I'll reserve my remaining time.
Not Illinois is one issue, and you say that was not?
There was no testimony by this gentleman that they didn't manufacture guns in Illinois.
Thank you. Ms. Christensen?
May it please the court, counsel. Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Joanna Christensen, and I represent Melvin Herbert in this matter. This case has been pending on appeal for some time, and our brief was initially filed more than a year ago. That's significant in this case because our brief was filed prior to Kimbrough and prior to the crack retroactivity amendments to the guidelines. And the issue has now become, based on what our brief was, is whether Mr. Herbert's case should be remanded for a Taylor remand in light of Kimbrough. The government objects to the Taylor limited remand based on the fact that at sentencing, the district court adopted the pre-sentence report's findings of 1.5 kilograms of crack, 150 kilograms of cocaine, and 30 kilograms of heroin. However, there's no evidence on the record specifically tying Mr. Herbert to that much individually, crack, cocaine, and heroin. He was primarily involved with crack, and most of the evidence in this matter was crack evidence. I'll dispose of two of the government's arguments rather quickly. One is that Mr. Herbert doesn't apply for a crack retroactivity amendment under 3582, and we concede that issue. Based on the guideline calculations, they would not change because of the retroactivity of the crack amendments. That's not what we're asking for in this case. We're asking for a Kimbrough remand, which is quite different in many respects from a crack retroactive amendment petition. The second argument is that the career offender guidelines are not affected by Kimbrough, and that's also not an issue in this case because Mr. Herbert's drug calculations were higher than the career offender calculations. So that really is not an issue on appeal for this court to consider. Finally, our basic argument is that Kimbrough can affect Mr. Herbert's sentence, but in fact, like Taylor and the cases that have followed since Taylor, there's no way for this court to know whether the district court would have imposed the same sentence had the court been able to consider the disparity between powder and crack cocaine at sentencing. As I stated before, the conspiracy involved crack, powder, and heroin. However, most of the evidence presented by the government regarding Mr. Herbert is involving crack cocaine.
Well, that's not really the deciding factor, though, because this was a conspiracy case, and so all of the drugs, including the heroin, is attributable to him.
True.
If the heroin amount gets him to the same guidelines range, then there's no reason for a Taylor remand.
Well, it gets into the same guidelines range, and we're not disputing the guideline calculation. Our argument is that the district court should be able to consider Kimbrough as a possible reason to sentence Mr. Herbert lower. We're not arguing that the guideline range should be recalculated because of Kimbrough. That's not an argument that is available to us because of the other drugs involved in this case. But it is a question as to whether the district court would be persuaded that if Mr. Herbert was substantially more involved in crack cocaine than the other drugs, although the conspiracy was also involved in the other drugs, that the district court may consider a lower sentence because of the disparity based on his involvement in crack cocaine.
Despite the presence of all the heroin.
Despite that fact. And this is where the Taylor remand becomes important, is that when Mr. Herbert was sentenced, this was not in the calculation a district court would make, even after Booker, because this court had said that the court couldn't consider that. So we're really left on appeal with no idea what the court would have done. In this case, the court did impose a lower-than-guideline sentence. It was still a sentence of 310 months, which is significant. And the court found some mitigating factors because Mr. Herbert was facing a sentence of 360 months to life. However, this issue was not raised. And the court's willingness to go below the guideline range suggests that the court would also be willing to consider the Kimbrough issue. A Taylor remand is not for we don't need to argue that the court would definitely impose a lower sentence. And the reason for that is that we don't know because of the record, and that's the mechanism that Taylor speaks to. I see that I am in my rebuttal time, and I shall reserve the rest for rebuttal.
Thank you. Ms. Gambino.
Good morning, Judge Sykes, Judge Ripple, and Judge Mannion. On behalf of Marvell Thompson, there are two issues that I would like to address this morning. First of all, the district court erred in finding that Mr. Marvell Thompson obstructed justice by lying in his plea colloquy, and that this lie was material either to the plea or to the sentencing. And secondly, that the sentence imposed in this case of 540 months was unreasonable in view of Mr. Thompson's lack of record, his age of 37 years old, rendering it essentially a life sentence. First, with respect to the obstruction of justice issue, the court said at sentencing that she found Mr. Thompson had lied at his plea colloquy by saying or denying that he was king of anything or that he didn't know about that. And this was problematic in two respects. First of all, it was a misunderstanding, a misquote, and a misinterpretation of what Mr. Thompson actually did say during the plea colloquy. There was much back and forth about what he needed to plead to. He was charged only with conspiracy, and the government had alleged quite a long series of facts in their indictment. However, it's only required that Mr. Thompson plead to the facts that establish the charge, the elements of the offense. In this case, the agreement to join the conspiracy, which he did. And this was a matter that was agreed to also by the government. In fact, the government said or took the position that based on his statements and admissions, he had admitted enough to plead guilty to count one and has satisfied all the elements of the conspiracy. What Mr. Thompson actually said during the plea colloquy was that as far as the Kings and all that, I told them 1,000 times that's not me. And the government, the court erred in taking this out of context as well, because Mr. Thompson was explaining that he was not the king of this gang in its entirety, that there were different geographical areas of responsibility, that he was responsible for one and not for the entirety. Now, this is not material in any respect either to the plea, because it doesn't have to do with any of the elements of the conspiracy charge, nor is it material to the sentencing, because there is a need to distinguish between a leadership role and in a conspiracy and the titular head king for a gang. Again, this is the difference between gang membership and membership in a conspiracy, which this court in Avila said there must be treated very carefully, because an agreement to join a gang is not the same thing as an agreement to join a conspiracy. In this particular case, it's a difference of who was Mr. Thompson leading, and for purposes of sentencing, Mr. Thompson had to be shown by his actions to direct specific individuals. So whether or not he was called a king of the whole gang, a part of the gang, or anything else, really was not material. So the court erred in finding that there was an obstruction of justice in this case, and for that reason denied Mr. Thompson his acceptance of responsibility points and added 2 additional points for obstruction of justice. Now, the government presents in their brief the argument that it doesn't matter because denying relevant conduct can be obstruction of justice. And while that is factually true, it doesn't apply in this case because that was not the basis of the court's ruling. She was very specific in saying that he lied in his plea colloquy with respect to the Kings. This was an error and should be redressed. Finally, with respect to the sentence of 540 months, Mr. Thompson had no prior felony convictions, had never served time in prison. There was no substantive evidence apart from the testimony or the allegations of fellow co-conspirators and informants that he was a part of this gang, and it was clearly an unreasonable sentence, and I will reserve the rest of my time.
Ms. Gambino, what is your position on the question of the Kimbrough remand?
With respect to Mr. Thompson?
Yes.
Mr. Thompson was not sentenced based on crack, and there is no Kimbrough issue in his particular case.
Thank you. Mr. McFadden.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, Christopher McFadden on behalf of the United States. This case resulted in the convictions of 46 members of the Black Disciple drug dealing conspiracy. That conspiracy put literally tons of crack cocaine, powder cocaine, and heroin worth millions of dollars on the streets of Chicago. And as for the 3 appellants here today, there's been no error. All of their convictions and sentences should be affirmed. I'd like to start first off with Derek White as well, and also with the Batson issue as well. And I'd like to restate the background because I don't think it was stated entirely accurately. During jury selection, the court informed the panel that this case could potentially ask them to give up a week and a half of their time. And then the court said, would this pose a problem for anybody? At that point, 2 people raised their hands and said, in their own words, that they had child care issues. One of them was Ms. Jackson. Ms. Jackson said that she had child care issues, but that it wasn't so much of a sitter. In her words, she said she didn't have a child care problem because her mother and a child care provider could watch the children. But, as one of you pointed out, she did say that she had 2 sickly children, including one who had hydrocephalus and another one who was born prematurely and often wheezed a lot. Ms. Jackson then expressed concern that if it was necessary for any of her children to go to the doctor for an illness, that no one would be able to take them to the doctor. And this is a quote, no one would be able to take them to the doctor and see if they are cared for properly. So, rightly understood, her concern is child care issues that may develop down the line. On the other hand, the concern of Ms. DeVries, who was Caucasian, she said also in her own words that she had child care issues, and her issues were that she had three children but no sitter during the day. The government's position at the for-cause point of the proceedings was that these two women were similarly situated. Either, and as a result, for cause, either both of them should be stricken or neither one of them should be stricken. And that position with respect to these two jurors was consistent with something else that the prosecutor said at the for-cause challenge, at the for-cause stage, when defense counsel was trying to strike other jurors for cause by saying that they had hardships with work or with school or what have you. The point that the prosecutors made is that jury selection, it is a duty, and it is a duty because to some degree it involves sacrifice. Everybody has a hardship of some type or another. And at the for-cause stage, if defense counsel is continually trying to shrink the jury pool to where it excludes people who are working, people who have children, people who may have school, you tend to be left not with a representative cross-section of the community. You tend to be left with people who don't have jobs, who are less skilled, who don't have families. And that's not a fair cross-section of the community either. All of those things can be proper basis at the peremptory stage, however, for striking someone. Now, and the government's articulated race-neutral reason for striking both of those jurors was that they had child care issues. However, I don't even think that the court needs to get to that issue, and that's because it is our position that defense counsel waived this issue in front of the district court. The waiver doctrine exists for two reasons. One of them is to make sure that somebody can't take one position, and then when the position doesn't work out, switch and try to take another position, which is what defense counsel tried to do here by agreeing to the proposal to move the African-American juror from the alternate panel onto the regular panel, and then trying to challenge that later. But another point behind the waiver doctrine is to make sure that this record is fully developed in front of the court when an issue comes up on appeal. And it's significant that when there were discussions as to how this third Batson challenge should be resolved, the district judge repeatedly asked defense counsel, how do you feel about this? He said that he thought it was an appropriate cure, and then there was this question and answer. First, she said, would this proposal be acceptable? Defense counsel said, that's fine, we have no objection. And then, this is in our excerpt of record at page 8 and 9, the question was, otherwise, I'm going to have to explore this further. The response from defense counsel, judge, we'll accept your proposal, the government's proposal. Judge, we'll take it. This was a strategic decision by defense counsel to limit the record and the fact-finding that was going to be done in front of the district court. It was also a strategic decision to accept this resolution of his objection. A Batson challenge is no different from any other type of objection. And if someone makes a strategic decision to solve that objection, they then should not be able to argue that position on appeal. And at this point, he was batting 0-for-2 on his Batson challenges. Both of them had been denied. There was a good chance, and I will argue again, that third strike also would have been denied. And so defense counsel made the strategic choice to live with the government's proposal.
Well, if there was an agreement, essentially a stipulation to that, why was the issue revisited just a little while later and dealt with substantively, as I read the chronology here? Maybe I've got it wrong, but I think it was.
I think the district judge found that there was the agreement, and then I think the prosecution brought it back up. Judge, we actually need a factual finding on the record because this is a serious issue, and I think that's why it came back. Now, 6 months later, and that factual finding, in the defendant's reply brief, he says there was no factual finding at the time. There was. There was a factual finding right there at the moment of the challenge. 6 months later, the district judge then said, when defense counsel tried to bring it up again, first she adhered to her findings, and then she said, and this is, I know that we cited in the brief where it was, she said that she thought there had been a negotiated settlement to this, and she really felt that this Batson issue had been resolved. So as we said in our brief, I think the district judge did find waiver, And I think I'll leave that at that. But if the court does get to the issue, the ultimate issue is whether the government discriminated against this juror, Ms. Jackson, and the government did not. Consistently throughout the Batson stage, and then 6 months later when the issue came up during post-trial motions, the prosecutor stated that we believe that the minds of these jurors would not have been on the trial, but it would have been on the care of their children. And now all I'm saying is that They are similarly situated. They're not identically situated, but they're similarly situated. And the prosecutors struck similarly situated jurors for race-neutral reasons that this court has previously recognized. We cited the U.S. versus Williams case. That involved a case where there was a strike of a black juror who was a single mother with several children. The articulated reason was that the prosecutors felt that the mother would not have been able to concentrate on the trial. That was the same race-neutral reason articulated time and time again in this case. This is not the type of case where the prosecutors shifted reasons. The first reason at for cause was strike either both of them or neither of them. But then when it came to the peremptory stage, the reason consistently articulated was that these two people were similarly situated. They had child care issues that might have kept them from concentrating on the trial. I'm going to move on to whether there was sufficient evidence to support the finding that Derek White was part of the drug dealing conspiracy and not just part of the gang. I think that the evidence was misstated by defense counsel when he said that all that Derek White admitted to was being part of the gang. That is not true, and we cited in our brief at page 21 and 22, we quoted extensively from the record, questions and answers from Chicago Police Detective James O'Brien. The question was, what did the defendant say after he waived his Miranda rights? And the answer, and this went in without objection, was that Mr. White stated that he was working security for the Black Disciple dope operation that evening. Not just working security, period. It was for the dope operation. And then later on, the question was, did you ask Mr. White who some of these drug sellers were that he was protecting? And the answer was, Mr. White said that somebody gave him a chrome revolver, and it just happened to be that this was a chrome revolver with the serial number obliterated off of it, and there was ample testimony that that's what the gangs do. They take the serial number and they wipe it off to make it impossible to trace that gun later on down the line, and I'll get back to that in a second. He said he didn't know who the people were that gave him the gun, but then he said, and we quoted this in our brief, he did not know any of the names of the people that were out there dealing drugs, any of the Black Disciples. That alone is direct evidence tying him not just to the gang, but to the conspiracy. But there's not just that. There also was his admission to Officer Shepard, which we also quoted in the record, and this is in the transcript at page 368, and this went in without objection, that Mr. White said to Officer Shepard that he was providing security. And then there was no objection to the next question, which was, what do you take that to mean, based on having worked in this district, where the Robert Taylor homes are and where they've been for 10 years? What do you take it to mean when somebody says that they're providing security at one of those high-rise projects? And the officer stated that that means that he is providing security for the gang. And providing security for the gang, then, there was ample circumstantial evidence that if you are providing security at one of those high-rises, that is tantamount to providing security for the drug conspiracy. Several members of the gang, including Mark Hall, and then Barney Volker was not part of the gang, but he was considered an outstanding member of the gang, and then Sergeant Moore, all testified at trial that the Black Disciples controlled that public housing project, that drugs were sold at that public housing project around the clock, and that security was always in place to protect the drug dealings at that project. So, really, if you're a member, if you're providing security, this is not some low-level position in the gang. You're not somebody who just shows up at the picnic of the drug. You're not just somebody who shows up at the picnic of the gang, on 4th of July for the birthday of its gang founder. If you're somebody who is providing security at the high-rise projects, if you're somebody who they give a gun to, you are somebody who they trust with a gun that belongs to the gang, a gun that has an obliterated serial number, a gun that you have to give back later on to the gang. This isn't just a foot soldier. This is somebody who is there and is working as part of a team to make sure that this dope dealing operation, which was the lifeblood of this gang, which ruined the lives of so many people in the city of Chicago for so many years, you are there, you are playing an intricate role in making sure that it succeeds. Also ignored in the opening statement was the testimony from Michael Matthews in front of the grand jury just a day or two after these shootings occurred. Michael Matthews was somebody whose girlfriend lived in that project, and so he was there often. And in the grand jury, he said that the defendant worked security for the Black Disciples, that the defendant searched people who came there to buy drugs, and that the Black Disciples controlled that building. Now, it's true that when he was on the witness stand at trial, Mr. Matthews tried to distance himself from that testimony. But in that respect, it's significant, as we pointed out, that before trial, Mr. Matthews met with Mr. White in the Cook County Jail for 90 minutes, and they talked. And why is that significant? It's significant because there was evidence in front of the district court that the Black Disciples not only beat and intimidate their own gang members, but they beat, intimidate, and kill people who are not in the gang that would try to turn on the gang. And so the jury clearly was entitled to consider Mr. Matthews' grand jury testimony as well.
Mr. Matthews was called in your case in chief adversely, I take it, based on his change of position?
Right. He was called in the case in chief. I believe he was treated as more or less a hostile witness because he had refused to meet with the prosecutors before trial. He was under subpoena. We didn't even know if he was going to be at the trial at the time. And then when he was there, he did give evasive answers. So he was,
his grand jury testimony came in to impeach his trial testimony?
Correct.
Okay.
And it was admitted, as we said in our brief, we cited the Gaho case, G-A-J-O. It was admitted under Rule 801 D1A by the district court. And finally, the jury had the right to consider conduct consistent by Mr. White with that of somebody who was providing security for the gang at the time. He came up to the police officer and for the gang's drug dealing conspiracy. He came up to the police officer, patted him down, yelled 5-0. On previous instances in 1998 or 99, he had asked a high-ranking gang member, Mr. Volker, for a blessing. In 1994, Sergeant Moore had been at that high-rise project, and when he came up and tried to speak with Mr. White, Mr. White called out for aid and assistance, which is a gang term, which means basically, hey, gang members, come and help me out. I'm in trouble. All of that suggests that this is somebody who knows who the high-ranking members are within the gang. He knows the gang terminology. He's someone who is trusted within that gang. And again, the gang doesn't trust just anybody with guns with obliterated serial numbers to protect their dope-dealing operations in the projects.
You said at which encounter did he yell aid and assistance when he was with the gun encounter?
No, aid and assistance was in 1994. He didn't have a gun at that point. He was standing in that same breezeway in the project, which is you have to go through there in order to get into the project, and then you're directed either to the north side to buy heroin or to the south side in order to buy cocaine.
Well, what was his declaration at the time of the encounter with the policeman who he eventually shot? Was that what did he say then?
Some
550 or something.
I understand your question. When the police officer got out of the car, Mr. White ran up to him, patted him down, yelled out 5-0, and then pulled out the gun and shot him in the back.
This patting down process, that's sort of unusual.
It's equivalent to a pat frisk that police
I understand what it is, but what is that? Is that something that a gang person would do, or what is the theory that somebody can go up and frisk someone and find I guess it was when he found the protective vest that he yelled that out.
Right. There was testimony. Nobody could get in and out of that building without being patted down by somebody who was working security. That person working security would always be a Black Disciple gang member, and because drugs were always being sold, they were always protecting not only people living there, but really what they were doing is they were making sure that nobody was getting in there without them being patted down by a gang member. And they're patting them down to see if they are law enforcement or if they have a weapon or if they have something that would interfere with the dope dealing operations going on in the high rise at that point. Moving on to the interstate commerce nexuses here. It's not at all unusual, as the court knows, for the expert to have no knowledge of where a gun actually came from or where the drugs actually came from. In fact, there is some case law, I believe, from the Ninth Circuit that says it's actually might be a good idea to have your experts not know the facts underlying the case, because if they do know the facts, they could cloud your expert opinion. I'll start with the gun. This gun, as we said, had an obliterated serial number, and the expert was able to testify that it was manufactured by Lorson. Lorson manufactured guns between 1989 and 1999. Lorson's facility was in Mira Loma, California. So by law, California is where Lorson is supposed to be making its guns. However, the gun also had a marking on the frame that said Nevada. That marking suggested that the gun may have been made in Nevada without a variance. There was a question, and this is on page 473 of the record. After the expert gave his opinion that the gun had traveled in interstate commerce, there was a question. Question, it was manufactured in Reno, Nevada and Mira Loma, California? Answer, yes. There was an adequate basis for the expert's opinion, namely the markings on the gun showing California and Nevada, which in his experience, those markings are consistent with where the site was where the gun actually was made. Now, granted, was the proof conclusive? No, it wasn't conclusive proof, but it was proof beyond reasonable doubt. And the experts was cross-examined by defense counsel, and certainly I think there was enough there for the jury to find that this gun had moved in interstate commerce from California or Nevada to Illinois. In that respect, I would point the court to the Groves case, not how Groves dealt with the gun, but how Groves dealt with the bullets. As for the bullets, the expert was able to identify who the manufacturers were of the bullets and was able to say that they were manufactured and had traveled in interstate commerce. And it's the same with the gun. The agent and the expert in this case was able to say that, in his opinion, the gun was made in California or Nevada, and that it then obviously traveled in interstate commerce to reach Illinois. And certainly it would be against common sense to suppose that there was somebody in Illinois stamping guns, California and Nevada, and that the gun had never moved across state lines. The jury was free to consider that and was equally free to reject that. As for the drugs in interstate commerce, this court and the Fourth Circuit, we have cited cases where appellate courts have recognized no cocaine is made in the United States, no heroin is made in the United States. The expert in this case did say that some pharmaceutical cocaine can be manufactured under controlled conditions in laboratories, but that pharmaceutical cocaine is strictly controlled by the Drug Enforcement Administration. And the way that it came out at trial, the expert on the cocaine said that there is no illegal cocaine made in the United States. And what he meant by illegal cocaine, it's clear from the record, nothing that you're going to find on the street was manufactured in Illinois. Certainly nothing on the streets on the south side of Chicago was manufactured in Illinois. And the same as to morphine. The expert testified that he was not aware, case was even stronger, as to the heroin. The operative ingredient in heroin is morphine, and the expert said that he was not aware of any pharmaceutical companies in the United States or in Illinois that manufacture morphine that could then be manufactured into heroin. I'm going to move on to Marvell Thompson, and I think the two issues raised in the oral argument were whether he should have gotten a reduction for acceptance and no enhancement for obstruction. At the plea colloquy, if the court flips through that, a lot of that is in Mr. Thompson's own excerpts. But on transcript page A12, the question is, what would the evidence show if this case went to trial? And if this case had gone to trial, the evidence would have shown beyond reasonable doubt that Marvell Thompson was the king and was the leader of the Black Disciples. This case was the United States versus Marvell Thompson and 45 other co-defendants. Marvell Thompson put tons of drugs on the streets. He controlled entire areas of the city. He controlled entire housing projects within the city of Chicago. He made millions and millions of dollars. He had people shot and beaten, and he made all the decisions about this gang. I agree that words like king are not controlling. However, when you are asked at the plea colloquy, do you admit to all these things? It is fine for a defendant to say, I'm only going to admit to the elements of the crime, and everything else, government, we're going to hold you to your burden of proof. But what you cannot do is you cannot go beyond holding the government to its burden of proof to then offering material misrepresentations. And that's what Mr. Thompson did in this case during the plea colloquy. He said that he denied 1,000 times that he was the king of the Black Disciples. There are cooperating witnesses lining up outside the door to testify that he was the king and he was the leader of the Black Disciples. He enforced street taxes. There was testimony that he made over $200,000 a day in dope dealing, that he mediated disputes between people when they were fighting about which corner belonged to whom. He kept tabs on his co-conspirators who he thought were cooperating with law enforcement. He owned an apartment building on the south side of Chicago which had a pirated radio station. This was 104.7 WCFL. It's a Christian radio station. He had a ham radio thing in his apartment, and he was able to jam the frequency on the south side of Chicago and broadcast news about the gangs and where police presence was and what areas to stay away from and who was getting in trouble with the gangs. The evidence was simply overwhelming, and we went through bullet point after bullet point in our brief showing that he was the leader of that conspiracy. Now, it was obstruction of justice to deny relevant conduct, to deny that he was the king of the Black Disciples. That clearly was material because it would affect his sentencing. It would affect whether or not he was the leader. It would affect whether or not he actually knew that the drugs that he was supplying to people were being supplied as part of a conspiracy and whether those drugs were then going to be put on the street of Chicago. And that ties into my point about why he was also properly denied a reduction for acceptance. In order to get an acceptance of responsibility, the burden is on the defendant to admit not only what he is charged with, but also to admit relevant conduct. And you can't minimize what you have done. And we pointed out in our brief that his plea colloquy was a textbook example of minimization. All that he was willing to admit to was that he put a couple hundred grams of heroin on the street, maybe 20 kilograms of cocaine on the street, and then the district court said, because that's not really enough for a factual basis. It was a conspiracy to possess with intent to distribute. The district court said, well, what did you think these people were going to do with all that cocaine? And his first response was, I really don't know. And then the district judge expressed skepticism, and then he finally admitted, only in response to those questions, that he knew they were going to put those drugs on the city, on the streets of the city, along with all the other tons and tons of drugs that he had supplied over the course of the conspiracy. In terms of the reasonableness of his sentence, the district judge considered all of the factors in this case. As we said in our brief, most of the factors that he cited were the types of things that district courts hear routinely. The district court made credibility findings. She found that one of the witnesses on the stand, Varney Volker, who had previously given damaging testimony to the gang, looked like he was frightened even to be there, speaking in the same room as Mr. Thompson. And so the district judge was afraid that he was going to relapse. Not only in the long term did he need to be deterred, but also in the short run he needed to be deterred, because clearly cooperating witnesses were afraid of him when they had to see him in the courtroom not very long after they had pled guilty and after he had pled guilty. As to Melvin Herbert, the issue is whether he should get a Kimbrough remand in this case. Kimbrough says that if a judge is laboring under a misimpression that he or she cannot deviate from the 100-to-1 ratio, that there should be, and that it might possibly affect your sentence, that you should get a remand. But in this case, it is clear nothing would change the range in this case. Mr. Herbert was held responsible not only for 1.5 kilograms of crack, but also for 150 kilograms of powder. So any 100-to-1 ratio is meaningless because his guideline range is not going to change. And in addition, he was also held accountable for 30 kilograms of heroin. So that also would not change the range.
I think the argument is that not that it would change the range, but that it would change the judge's exercise of discretion, which is actually what the Kimbrough holding was.
Right.
The disparity in the crack powder sentencing range is an appropriate discretionary factor for the judge to consider, and that didn't happen here.
It can be, and I think the way that we argued it in our briefs is that if there's some basis to suppose that there may have been that things might be different on remand, then maybe you would be entitled to one if the range would change. Again, the range wouldn't change here, though. Whether or not, even if we took crack completely out of the picture, the range wouldn't change. And the district judge did consider equities and already came to a below-guideline sentence, and there's no reason to suppose that that would have been any different on appeal. Unless there are any questions, I would submit the rest of the case on the briefs. And we would ask that the convictions and the sentences of all the appellants in this case be affirmed. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Leonard, how much time? You've got 2 minutes left.
I was struck by counsel's statement that they really are the good guys here. They were seeking a cross-section. 44 out of 50 of the veneermen were white. By the time the peremptory challenge came down, there were 5 blacks left. They tried to get rid of 3 of them. They were caught, and they sought a cure that they suggested to the court because they didn't have an adequate basis. Then they made a statement that, well, we concede she doesn't have a child care issue, but they suggested it's okay to just make something up and say, well, we're really concerned that she'll be thinking about child care, even though she doesn't have a problem. That's not an honest basis, and the judge never made a finding. And with respect to waiver, I submit, and the court can look at these two quotes at the time of the colloquy with the judge, bookend statements at page 177 of the trial transcript, both, meaning both jurors, Jackson and Pierre, both should be on. Move the alternate up and give us one more. That was at the beginning. At the end, just so the record is clear, our position is that Jackson should be impaneled, but I understand Your Honor's ruling. That cannot be a waiver. With respect to the quote the counsel did give the court, that was a quote when we were discussing who should be the alternate. The question was, we move Pierre up, the black juror, who should be the alternate? And there was dialogue about whether it would be Mr. Garrett or somebody else. And I did make the statement, I accept that proposal about that alternate. That had nothing to do with the question of Ms. Jackson. And finally, with respect to Mr. White's statements, I urge the court to look at the cross-examination of O'Brien. Mr. White said he was working security. But let's just assume for sake of argument, he said I was working for the dope operation. What does that mean? According to their witness, the only co-conspirator to testify anything about Mr. White stated affirmatively, there are hundreds of BDs, hundreds of gang members who have nothing to do with this 45-person conspiracy. So the government's position is untenable. Just because someone is a BD and is involved in any aspect of drug operations in the city of Chicago, that does not provide the nexus to this 45-person conspiracy. Thank you.
Ms. Christensen, you've got 1 minute left.
Thank you, Your Honors. I'll just briefly talk a little bit. I believe the court understands the distinction in the argument that we're making between whether Kimbrough changes the guideline range or whether Kimbrough can be a discretionary factor. I would cite United States versus Liddell, which was just decided a few weeks ago. Of course, it's not cited in my brief, and I can certainly brief that for the court if necessary, which describes the difference between the changing the guideline range argument and the discretionary argument. I believe the court called it a nuanced argument, different from the change in the guidelines. Secondly, the government said that there's no reason to suppose on the record that the sentence would have been different. That's the whole point of Taylor. If there was a reason to suppose on the record that the sentence would have been different, then Mr. Herbert would be entitled to a full remand because the district court thought itself constrained by this court's prior rulings prior to Kimbrough. Because it's simply because it's not on the record is the reason that a Taylor remand is utilized by this court, the same reason that Palladino was used after Booker, because there's no evidence to see where the district court would have gone after Kimbrough. And I thank you for the court's time and urge the court to remand for a Taylor limited remand in this case. Thank you.
Ms. Gambino? You also have 1 minute left.
With respect to Mr. Thompson's sentencing, it's important to note that there were two members of this charged conspiracy, which was located primarily in the Calumet building and the Robert Taylor homes, neither of which were on the south side of Chicago where Mr. Marvell Thompson lived and where he was primarily located. And the agent testified that of all of the hundreds of hours of Title III recordings, there were no recordings of Mr. Thompson. There was no surveillance of Mr. Thompson engaged in drug activities. There were no there was no witnessing of him, no controlled buys with Mr. Thompson in drug activities, and there were no drugs nor drug paraphernalia found in his residence, businesses, or vehicles. The two that testified at his sentencing hearing, this Boker, the person to whom the government refers as an individual who was afraid, described himself as a shot caller. He said, "It was my whole operation, so I ran the operation the way I wanted to." He, meaning Thompson, couldn't make decisions on what was taking place on our side of town. Guys do not listen to what Marvell have to say if they don't want to. We going to do what we want to do, period. This man was not a man expressing fear. This was a man expressing pride in his own control over his own business. With respect to whether Mr. Thompson was a king, again, the important issue is, was he a leader organizer, and did he lie by saying he wasn't a king? That was not a material lie. The court erred, and we ask that Mr. Thompson's case be remanded for resentencing.
Thank you very much. Our thanks to all counsel. The case will be taken under advisement.